An Artist and a Planet is a series of podcasts created by MIMA, Middlesbrough Institute of Modern Art. MIMA is the Tees Valley's gallery and community hub, the creative heart of the School of Arts and Creative Industries, and part of Teesside University. This podcast series was inspired by MIMA's dedication to the environment. We talk with artists and researchers about ecology to share behind-the-scenes research from MIMA's artistic programme and interdisciplinary research from across Teesside University. Hello and welcome to this conversation as part of the An Artist and a Planet series. There's three of us here having a chat today. So I'll introduce myself first. My name's Ali Reid. I work at MIMA. I'm also a doctoral researcher working on oceans.
My name's Amy Dover. I'm an artist and illustrator with a focus on the natural world, particularly non-human animals. I'm also a senior lecturer here at MIMA School and Teesside University and course leader for our brand new undergrad in illustration. I'm also a PhD candidate at Newcastle University, practice based in fine art with a bit of a tour in environmental sciences and art history as well.
Hi, my name is Ambroise Baker. I'm a senior lecturer in ecology, and I'm interested in all things ecological, ecosystems, and in particular for my research and teaching, I'm interested in understanding how plants, biodiversity and ecosystem respond to environmental change, and all of this with the idea to have a better grasp of how to accelerate ecological recovery.
Ah, amazing. Yeah, very interesting. So the three of us, we decided to get together today and have a bit of a chat about extinction, because that's a theme which runs through, I guess, well, definitely through Amy's work and through Ambroise's work and a little bit through mine, although with oceans, I think we tend to talk much more about kind of depletion and disruption of systems than we do about extinction. But to start us off, I picked up some information which is published on the BBC, because they've been featuring quite a lot of stuff about extinction at the moment. And it's really just to start off with some quite basic facts. So the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or the IUCN, keeps a red list of threatened species, and it's done that since the 1960s. And they've assessed more than 140,000 species. They consider 29% of them to be endangered, I think, which is a lot. And that includes, I think, 25% of mammals. And looking at this again, more than a third of all reef corals around the world. So I find extinction such a difficult topic, because it's comparatively easy to talk about it in terms of statistics like that. Like, I can sit there and look at those numbers and go, oh, that's really a big topic then, like, we should all know about that, we should all be more concerned about it. But getting beyond the statistics, I find really quite difficult. Like, I see those numbers, I don't really know what to do with that. And I imagine that's the same with a lot of people who may then just get quite worried or wonder what they can do about it, which is one sort of a reaction. But just more thinking and more talking about it is, I think, something we really need to think about. So I'll just throw that open to both of you and see if you want to take that up.
Yes, I agree with you on these numbers. They can scare, and it's because also we don't understand everything that's happening and how that's happening, where it's happening, what sort of, you mentioned mammals. They are evolutionary. They are cousins. Are we also threatened part of this extinction threat? So that's very worrying.
Yeah.
And it is part of what we call the biodiversity crisis that runs alongside the climate change crisis. And it is a very important thing that we're going to have to deal with in a way or another in the coming years and decades and more.
Mm.
I think as well, as humans, we often kind of forget that we're part of nature. Like, we see those statistics and we see these things that are happening, we kind of other it a little bit and think, oh, that's happening to other species and it's really sad. But we forget that we're kind of part of that ecosystem, and that our impact on the planet is going to cause our own demise as well, which I know is pretty dark and pretty scary. But I think we live in a world that's so separate from nature as well, that we kind of, we see that and we do worry about it. But I just don't think a lot of people feel engaged to do a huge amount by it. And it's such a big thing. It's really hard to know where to go with it. And I think a lot of the focus tends to be on the sort of the big animals. There's a lot of talk about, you know, the polar bears and the tigers, and everybody talks about that. And I kind of got interested in illustrating extinct species because I realized what I was drawing was disappearing. And I was like, oh, great, I'm drawing animals that might not exist in the future. Mm. And my research now was much more focused on British species.
Right.
And I think as we look at kind of the tigers and things like that, we don't consider, we're losing hedgehogs and starlings in this country. And that's like really shocking. Mm. And nobody even is really talking about that. You watch these big production TV shows and all of the kind of big marketing from the WWF, but there's just not a huge amount about all these like key species in Britain that we're losing as well.
Mm, it's true.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a lot of emotional relationship with extinction because it's so, it sounds so irreversible and so dramatic. And I imagine all members of the public and even people researching it all their life don't have a full picture. It's difficult to get a full picture of all this, and how much does a hedgehog weigh against an elephant in Africa? It's very difficult to put any sort of priorities or understand where we need to take action. I guess many environmental minded people find that petrifying.
Yeah, I agree.
I think most people find it quite petrifying, actually. Perhaps the more so, the more that you look into it. So just on the way in this morning, I was thinking about, there's a book I read quite recently, which is by, there's an American writer, Barbara Kingsolver, who I think she used to be a biologist. She's based in the States. I think she lives in Arizona or the southern area of the States. She used to be a biologist. She became a writer of fiction. And so she wrote a book called Flight Behavior, which is a fictional book, but it's about extinction. It's about the monarch butterflies and their projected extinction. And it's about really the difficulties that face both the scientists who work with them and the community around the scientists who are kind of struggling with the lack of communication and the difficulties of that story that an extinction might be kind of happening in their own area, their own landscape. And I just remember there was a line from it that really stood out to me. I don't think I've got this exactly right, but she said something like, not everybody can witness the end of a species. So she was talking about the pressure on the scientists and the people just trying to understand what was going on, and just the enormity of it, I guess, or the finality of extinction. Those things are very difficult to grasp.
Yeah, I think that's more and more that's idea of the difficulties of observing a species going extinct is also true in the scientific world.
Yeah.
In that it's of course it's very emotional, so difficult to tease apart things. But increasingly, research shows that when a species is about to go extinct, it has already gone through a process of losing abundance of population, and really the last step to extinction is a minor step in the what the species has experienced.
Okay.
And there is a greater focus now on focusing on having effort to keep species and population abundant as possible, not only as a number of species like the IUCN you were mentioning, but also creating the condition where all these species can be abundant rather than just having like a collection of all these species still on the planet.
Okay.
Do you not think it's like, I don't know what your perspective is as a scientist, but a lot of my research is around kind of the cultural representations and how that affects. Like butterflies, for example, in the Renaissance period were seen as gatekeepers to the underworld, and you get these incredible paintings of people getting attacked by butterflies because they were going to hell. And like there's so much kind of cultural kind of references My work's about how we kind of represent that through art and how that affects us. But there's so many animals. I've just read a great book called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, about our kind of dichotomy, kind of that relationship we have with different animals, about how some are members of our family, others are just food. I've done a lot of research around vultures because people really hate vultures and they're so important as well. As Ali knows, I've just done a residency in the jungle with an indigenous tribe, and their relationship with vultures was really interesting. I went there to learn from kind of indigenous communities and how they kind of work with nature and how they look after it. And they have this big, amazing leatherback turtle rescue, and we saw leatherback turtles giving birth on the beach in the middle of the night. That was incredible. And the nature there is unbelievable. But the vultures are everywhere and they just don't even notice them. And they're giant and they're just all over the village, just everywhere. And they're like, oh, we don't like the vultures. And I'm like, this is so weird. Like, they're
Bizarre.
so like
Yes,
living
yeah.
on the nature. So they have recently got kind of like plastic. So they've got things like Coca-Cola cans and crisps and chocolate. And because they've lived the same way for so long and they've only had organic matter, they don't know what to do with the rubbish. So they don't have bins. So there's just litter everywhere. And they've just got rubbish dumps and they dump a lot of it on the beach. So then there's all these vultures that are effectively, they're kind of like bin men. They kind of like clean it up. So like we would be having dinner and then we would be kind of clearing out waste and like doing our washing up. And then all the vultures would be sat in the trees just waiting over us after our dinner to come and clean up. And I found that really interesting. And I know they kind of have that kind of quite evil, dark look, and they
Yeah,
represent,
from
especially like
cartoon
Disney and things
representations.
like that. And it's so interesting that people care so much about one species and they don't about another just because of the kind of cultural representations of them. I don't know if you have any of that kind of working as a scientist or whether yours is very much on kind of like data and statistics.
I went into science because I'm more into data and statistics, but we had a student that did a really interesting project on the cultural side. What you said just remind me about, she looked at how the film Jaws, about that fanciful, huge, white shark, has influenced our mind and is probably an impediment for shark conservation and the wider marine conservation also. So that was a very, very interesting a thought. And I think it's true. We've got very different relationship with all these organisms. And I'm sure your experience with the vultures changed your whole perspective and emotional relationship with that type of bird also.
Yeah, well, about a year before I went to the vulture kind of rewilding project in Mallorca, and that was so different. And they were trying to bring them back, and there was this amazing kind of, I guess, large enclosure of vultures that were kind of damaged wings and stuff that couldn't fly anymore. And they're just unbelievable creatures. They're incredible. And they were trying to kind of rewild. And it's quite interesting that in Europe we've done so much damage and now we're trying to bring it all back. And then to go to Panama and see things disappearing, it felt really kind of uncomfortable to know what our impact was on a kind of the, I guess, a kind of, well, not really global south because it's Central America, but you know what I mean? Or the impact that we've been having and seeing things disappear in a
Yeah, and under
country
the
with really high
context.
biodiversity as well.
But I think all these stories are also a great way to explain why does it matter all that biodiversity disappearing? Because these organisms have got a function and they are actor in the whole landscape, in ecosystems, in around our lives. And it's when we if we lose a species, we not only lose a species, we lose a whole range of effects they've got around there. In their environment, and I've just in my notes I've got that example because I remember one time a colleague told me, "Oh, I've done a radio interview and they asked me why protect biodiversity." I didn't know what to say,
It's a huge
and
question.
it is a huge question. And many people would think, "Oh, yeah, I'd like to keep more biodiversity," but you don't. Emotionally, that's quite easy to think. But pragmatically, what does it bring to your everyday life? In the 80s, there was that, I think they are a couple, it's Ehrlich and Ehrlich. They wrote a paper about the rivet hypothesis. I'd say it's more a rivet analogy. And the idea of a plane going across the Atlantic and back, London to New York, say, on a daily basis, holds together because there are all these rivets holding all the wings and the rest of the engine. Now, it does happen with all the vibration and all that. Imagine that every trip there is one rivet falling in the Atlantic. Of course, it's all right to go back and forth quite a few times, but you need to know that at some point there need to be an engineer coming in and saying, "Oh, I think we need to check all the rivets that it's going to hold. Everything's going to hold together." There is at some point a breaking point where there is one rivet too many missing, and the function of all these rivets that were put at the beginning won't hold anymore, and the plane's just going to crash, maybe in the ocean, maybe just on the landing. But that's the idea that all the organisms, whether vulture, shark, and so on, those we like, we don't like, we know, we don't know, because there are still so much biodiversity we don't know, they all have got potentially some sort of function that's totally under research, but and we may have already lost some, but the more we lose, the more we take the risk of having dysfunctional yes. ecosystems and surprises like a crash. That's for the analogy, but yes. I think it helps.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's really helpful.
Getting an idea of one reason why we'd like to conserve biodiversity. Mm. Oh, I'm a big advocate for rewilding because it's one way we've got, or we can apply that. We think that will revive ecosystem, the environment, and enhance all the relationship between plant and animals, and also a way to increase abundance. And it's a sort of ambitious agenda for conservation and restoration of habitat. So I always try to put it forward to start a discussion. So thanks, but. What's interesting with it, and that goes with what we were saying just before, it's we are deciding to move one organism, usually large charismatic ones, not only because we think that species is under threat or we need it's been lost, or not really in relation to extinction, but precisely for their function, to add more rivet to the plane. So that's I think that's a fantastic approach.
Because the beaver's been really successful, hasn't it? The reintroduction of the beaver. And I love that wild boars rewilded themselves yeah. as well.
Yes.
They have a big symbolism too. They're really taken to represent courage, I think.
Ah. Like
probably not in every culture, but they've got a particular resonance, kind of courage and independence. Yeah.
Because animals like wolves and bears and wild boar and things like that were all kind of associated with pagan and Celtic and Druid mm-hmm. kind of hunting magic. Because I've been doing a lot of research around that.
Yeah.
I research a lot on the bear. I love drawing bears. I think they're incredible.
Many of your drawings of bears. they are beautiful.
I absolutely love them. And people are absolutely terrified of rewilding bears. And I just went to Romania to see them in the wild. And they're unbelievable creatures, and there's like 10,000 of them there, and people live with them. And I know there's still a bit of controversy there, and people still hunt them, and there's still problems with them coming into human habitats, but that's mainly because human habitats are expanding. But imagine if there was bears in Britain, like what would that do?
I had no idea there were so many in Romania.
Yeah,
I never would have guessed that.
It's kind of because of communism. So when I was in Romania, they were obviously like, "Oh, communism was horrible, but at least we have these incredible forests,
yeah,
and like wild bears and wolves and stuff." But bears are still kept in tiny cages as entertainment around there. I mean, I met this incredible bear who had been rescued from Ukraine.
Yeah,
so he'd been kept in a cage his entire life next to a hotel in Ukraine just as entertainment, which was horrific. Because of the war, they had to get him out, and he was in this rescue center, and he was just It was the biggest bear they had in it's called Liberty Bear Sanctuary. It's the biggest bear rescue in the world. And he was enormous, but so friendly. And we were like talking to him and he was coming over to see us. And he was amazing. Yeah. And you talk about the kind of, charismatic species and we want to rewild them. But it would be really interesting to see kind of what would happen if we brought back those species that, I mean, the bear was very much vilified in kind of, like we lost it 1,500 years ago here, around about the time kind of Christianity was rising and the bear was associated with kind of paganism and the lion was associated with Christianity. It was kind of vilified there. And I think that's kind of interesting that that kind of cultural thread has had such an impact on such a huge creature too, and what people's emotions are about that now as well.
Yeah, there's that Shakespeare line, exit pursued by a bear, which is so famous. It's from A Winter's Tale. And it's really to do, it's representative of nature being in chaos, so basically everything being in chaos, and the actor gets pursued off the stage.
Do you know what a berserker is?
No.
So there used to be these fighters that they were believed were half man, half bear, and they were called berserkers. So when you go berserk, that's where it comes from. It comes from berserkers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's quite cool.
Yeah. Amazing. Can I just ask about rewilding? Because I think a lot of people tend to think that it means you leave something to itself, an area of land, and it kind of rewilds itself. But actually, there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
There is. There definitely is. It's, of course, there is the word itself, rewilding. There is a wild insight and bringing back the wilderness. And also over time, it has a bit evolved. It started in the 90s, and then there was a big impetus about rewilding as a sort of umbrella word from the 2005 and so. And it means very different things to different people. Some people want to rewild, for example, a road verge, meaning maybe less cutting, less, and it's a very small scale with smaller organism. And other people see rewilding as opening up all the spaces you can, landscapes you can, and bringing back even from the 2005 Dunland's proposal was to bring lions and elephants to North America. So that was very controversial, and the people are all finding, and in every country, finding all the options and how to make it fit within the possibilities. But in Britain, there is the beaver that you were mentioning. And that's at the moment in Scotland, there are lots of them. In England, there are lots of little pockets, and it's something that lots of people are collecting evidence for, what how beneficial it is, what are the disadvantages of it. So it's all, this is done all in a, I'd say, very controlled manner. If you think of rewilding as a word, just think of the wild. For some people, it's maybe not controlled enough in that there can be beavers escaping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what one aspect that's, and that goes well with all the cultural aspect you were mentioning, that I think now rewilding will need to think more about, and it has been a bit of a failure in the past, and it goes with our society increasingly seeing humans as one animal amongst the others, rather than that pyramidal idea that there is God at the top, then human, and then all the creatures that God created. Locating ourselves in our biology amongst all these animals. And there is, of course, all veganism that goes with this, and animal welfare. And I mean, animal welfare is an aspect of rewilding that I believe will require more attention in the future. And that's for the animals that we may be releasing. How are the landscape fully suitable for them? But also to give a positive image to all this enterprise to keep biodiversity in the landscape, so that there is more and more people supporting this.
Yeah, I think there's a big need for like kind of humans to rewild themselves and become kind of greater connected with nature and live amongst nature and to even have like nature around our homes. And I think rewilding should extend to us as well. And I do think we do forget that we're apes. I think we're the only apes in kind of Europe apart from the what do you call them?
In Gibraltar,
yeah, the Gibraltar,
monkeys
yeah,
there.
The monkeys
I
in
don't
Gibraltar.
Think they're ape technically,
Sorry,
but they are
primates.
monkeys.
Sorry,
Yeah.
primates.
No, that's
But
all.
we're the only apes in Europe, and I think we've completely forget that we're so closely related to bonobos and chimpanzees and stuff. And I think humans need to have that greater connection. Yeah, we need to rewild ourselves, not just nature.
Do you think that started to happen with the pandemic?
I think it did, but then I think everybody's just gone back a little
Do you think
bit.
so? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so,
You
personally.
agree?
I don't. I'm sure some people research it and will tell you also that
Yeah,
result. But
it's early
personally,
days.
that's the feeling I have.
But people are going back to
Yeah.
villages. Yeah.
And I think like the kind of eco-green thing has become really fashionable. That lots of kind of brands and companies are hopping on it. There's a lot of greenwash happening now, and it's become really fashionable to show that you care about nature. But
It
it
has.
not doesn't necessarily mean like there's just that big like boohoo campaign that's come out that's supposedly green, and boohoo are one of the most polluting fashion companies around, which is quite interesting that it's just become like a fashion thing now. And I have a lot of students that do projects on helping nature, and they're like, oh, I really care about this, and they do a project and I'm like, but what are you actually doing yourself? Like, are you actually doing these things? And it's quite interesting that people care and they want to look like they care, but I think people are really worried about changing their everyday lives, and I think that's a big, big thing.
Yeah, there is potentially a worry, but there is also an we've never been taught how to make these changes. What meant exactly what changes? Some of them are obvious, but many of them might feel very alien to most people. And that's something that's also increasingly being realized is that many people are so disconnected with the natural environment. That's yes, we care about it, but it's through a bit of a screen, and there isn't a direct connection. And that's something I think if people want to do something about the environment, first of all, is to speak about it and make sure everybody got a chance to go out and enjoy. And that would be a first step. I think people will be more likely to make other changes maybe to their lives afterwards.
Do you think we're looking for kind of a bit of a roadmap? For want of a better word, take the road out of it, a map, a way forward.
Have you guys read Dark Ecology by Timothy Morton? It's
No, I
quite an
haven't.
interesting book, but he talks quite a bit in it about how we get in our car and we turn on the ignition and we don't consider that it's damaging the planet, and that tiny little action isn't, but collectively all together us getting in our cars, turning on the engine is having such a detrimental effect on nature. And that kind of your everyday life, you don't really quite register it. And I think that that's a quite interesting conversation as well. That those kind of little bits and bobs kind of accumulate together.
Yeah, I mean, maybe with things like that, I guess there's a sense that, okay, well, everybody does this, and so I'll just do it. And, people kind of, they're worried about it, but it's hard to break habits, isn't it? And then sometimes people, I guess, don't really, they see loads of people doing something. So they kind of think, well, what difference will it make if I don't do it or if I switch?
But at the same time, it gives hope because you're
Yeah.
saying it's all little things. So there are also all little things we can do to reverse this and
Yeah.
do exactly go exactly the other way. It's sometimes just a collective slight mental block we've got. But if
Yeah.
it's more acceptable to come arrive in the office a bit sweaty because you cycled there, it will make a huge difference. Everybody can do it. And you don't have to do it every day. You can do it once a month. It will already do a fantastic difference.
Well, I've been working on a project with our lovely Professor Sarah Perks and our Mimer Art Gallery, and it's also with Natural England, their Natural Futures project. Sorry, there's lots of stakeholders in this. Teesside Valley Nature, and who else? Borderlands as well. So we've been doing a big project about how we can kind of use creativity to make people feel more connected to nature. We have this wonderful nature connectiveness, which is not the nicest word, scale that we've been
It's
working on.
something.
And from one of my workshops, I spent months doing a life-size portrait of a bear, and then I installed it in a gallery in Newcastle called Newcastle Contemporary Arts, and I didn't tell anybody what I was doing, and I installed it on the wall, and it was an event called Ladies Wine and Design, where everybody gets together and kind of connects kind of the design industry to kind of empower women. And after everybody had a few glasses of wine, I did a bit of a talk about kind of nature and bears and stuff, and then I invited people to destroy my drawing and rub it out, which is one of the scariest things I've ever done. It was quite terrifying to see people destroy something that took me months, yeah. And I couldn't get people to do it at first. Nobody would do it. Luckily, one of my really good friends, Sarah, was there. I was like, Sarah, you're just gonna have to bite the bullet and get involved with it. And my friend Julie like did the first bit, but everybody was so delicate, they were so scared of ruining this drawing, which was quite interesting. And but the whole point of it was to kind of make everybody feel like they were part of the destruction of nature and make everybody feel responsible, but do something that was so direct. That was the idea. I don't know if it comes across as
that.
Did
they say what was scary about it to them?
They just hated the idea of destroying something that took so long to do. And the bear itself kind of looks out at you while you're doing it. I kind of drew it like that as well.
Also, I guess for them, they had the whole creation in front of them, and they could see directly the impact, which is not really the case when we on all these
that's true.
Small things throughout our days that are negative to the environment. So making people more aware, like in this case, they couldn't escape it.
Yeah.
Stop them, I imagine.
Yeah, because it's like when people are talking about kind of meat consumption and then they tell people how many animals you would save if you didn't eat meat, that things like that, if you kind of a bit more direct with people, it has a bigger impact, doesn't it? And I just don't think you see directly what you're doing, what it does to nature. Yeah, I want to make people feel, I know it's not very nice, but make people feel responsible for what they're doing a little bit. Yeah.
Just more conscious of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll try and pull it together into a final quite big question before we exit, not pursued by a bear in this case. So how we've talked about the emotion around extinction and biodiversity loss and how much that affects people. And then I think also about curiosity, about people wanting to know what they can do or what changes they can make. This is a hard question. I don't know the answer to it at all, but what happens next? How do we get through that situation? How do we progress those kinds of conversations? Any thoughts? It's
good question.
Hard. I don't know.
Well, on the sheet you sent us, so you were also speaking about human creativity.
That's right, yeah.
And that inspired me. I've put a few notes, so I think it answers your question, but maybe
I'll focus on the creativity
because I thought it was, it may sound like when you're asking someone who's doing science the role of creativity, where it is, they will say nothing, it's just work, and you need to be pragmatic and so on. But to be very pragmatic, if we want to, as a society, to do something about extinction and promote biodiversity, I really think that creativity will be absolutely key. We are in a world where everything's been transformed. All these species assemblages, the plant and the animal that live together, wouldn't live together if it were for the human agency. The minerals have been moved around. There are cities that are totally new environment for all these plant and animals and so on. We are in a situation, the climate is different. Everything's different. So I think there, it's not only conservationists, not only scientists, but everybody needs to be creative and find new ways to do as much as possible for biodiversity. And maybe important to understand the level and the abundance of population that were in the past, but we have to project that knowledge in a world that's totally new, and there the creativity will be absolutely key. I think all efforts towards biodiversity without creativity, which means looking back and thinking, oh, we've lost all that, we need to put it back, or we need to do something. We absolutely need that creativity, see it in a different way, and being positive will help.
Yeah, I think for a long time, kind of the arts and science have been separated when they used to be together, and it used to be really important. You have to think creatively when you're a scientist, because you've got to kind of think of new ideas. And I think the arts and science have been kind of seen as two very separate things. And there's a big kind of call for SciArt now to kind of bring things back together, because it's so important to kind of reach out to people through kind of new ways of perceiving things and representation. And I 100% agree with what you're saying there. And I think we have to be really creative about it, because what we're doing at the moment isn't working. And we have to make a shift and a change, yeah.
Yeah, I agree very much. I'm just conscious this is quite an unusual opportunity that we had here today to have a scientist here and a creative practitioner. And then I work from a creative discipline, which is with language, but I work a lot more and more with science and ecology and geography. So to have that mix of things, I think even just in this room, has been really, really interesting. And I agree, those divisions that we've had in the past are starting to mean less and less, I think. MEMA is committed to environmental responsibility and promotes new understandings of ecology. Follow MEMA Useful on social media or visit MEMA.art to find out about exhibitions, activities and events.